For those of you who weren't here last night, perhaps a word of explanation about the altar is in order. Looks like we're having a jumble sale right after the service, doesn't it? Last night we had a really wonderful creative program of the stories of six different disciples of Master telling in their own words their experiences with the Master and all the different items on the altar in one way or another related to their stories. So it's a pleasant memory for those of us who are here and an enticing idea for those of you who missed it to go onto the internet eventually when the recording will be posted. And also just to explain, we do things a little odd, but this one I think tops it all. The reading that we just heard talks about this light shining in darkness, and a great deal of the emphasis is talking about the light. But I think at the other side of it is to talk about what the darkness is. And I'm thinking somewhat of the stories last night. One of the disciples who was represented is Rajasi Janakananda. He was an American man named James J. Lynn. And he was Yogananda's most advanced male disciple, and in many ways the dearest person, in the sense that Master felt he was able to give so much to him. The Masters love us all equally, and the only difference is our ability to receive that love. So if a Master feels particularly close to some disciple, it's because he's able to unite more of his own spirit with that disciple. And Rajasi was one who was able to take everything from Master. When Yogananda was leaving for India in 1935, and when he was in India in 1935, he wrote a number of letters back to Rajasi and essentially said, if it weren't for you, I don't know if I would come back to America. Because so much of America was so uncongenial to his spirit. But Rajasi made it all worthwhile. And Rajasi in his monologue last night said to us that at a certain point from Master he received this extremely deep state of samadhi in which he was able to perceive the true light that is everywhere and is always shining. And he said after that, he said it was as if my own life was projected on a screen in front of that experience. That's just a fantastic way to think about it, isn't it? We're always moving in our external life from a deeper level even of our own selves. We have a whole series of thoughts and feelings, and usually almost no one is really privy to the deepest part of ourselves. And so we present to the world to varying degrees who we're habituated to be, who we want them to know, who we have the courage to express. And there's always this deeper level. But for us, most of the time, that deeper level is not the bright light of spirit. It's the place of contractive self-identification. So that we try to bring out, sometimes what we're bringing out is the best, and we're holding all the rest of it. And Swamiji was asked once, the question was raised to him. He said, is the difference between an ordinary human being and a master, is it comparable, let's say, to the difference between an ordinary human being and a dog in terms of the spectrum of consciousness? And Swami's answer was fascinating. He said, and he had said this at an earlier time, he said, even animals are egos. They have less defined egos, and as they progress up the animal cycle, and dogs and monkeys and horses, Master said, were the most advanced. Cat lovers argue against that, but that's what he said. Dogs and horses and monkeys are the most advanced on the spectrum in terms of having differentiated egos and being able to be self-aware. You see, the definition of expanded consciousness is our degree of self-awareness. And ultimately, that self-awareness translates into self-realization, we actually understand. What makes animals limited is they have a very low degree of self-awareness. They cannot objectify their own experience and then apply their willpower to it in the same way that a human being can do. Yes, dogs and monkeys and horses can be exceedingly clever in terms of determining what it is they want and then figuring out how to get it. But they still can't abstractly consider the position of dogs' relation perhaps to the position of cats, the position of dogs in the developing world versus dogs in the privileged world, and so on. So what we're working with, Swamiji said, is we're working with degrees of ego on a spectrum between complete ignorance and self-realization. And of course, the more advanced we become as human beings, I don't mean advanced technologically or educationally, but advanced in our understanding of who and what we really are, we identify less with the ego and more with the spirit. So we move up the spectrum and the percentage of identification, spirit-ego, gets smaller and smaller. Okay? So, but Swamiji said we're still on that spectrum. Dogs and human beings are still on that spectrum. The difference between a regular human being and a master, he says, is infinite. Because a master recognizes infinity in everything. So there's, between a dog and a person, it's still a measurable distance. Between a regular person and a master, the difference is infinite. Isn't that just extraordinary to contemplate? So much going through the lives of the disciples we were talking about last night, and just let me try to find where this is. From a saint's perspective, when you're farther up that spectrum and you're closer to infinity, everything reverses. I was thinking about the life of Saint Francis of Assisi. It's a well-known life and a beautiful life. He was the only son of a very wealthy merchant. He had every privilege that human beings aspire to have. He had position in society. He had wealth. He had a mother and a father who wanted everything that was best for him. Everything he desired was given to him. He had a magnetic personality. He was the leader of his generation of friends. They would go out in the night and they would sing and they would parade through the streets. And he would, during the day, he worked in his father's shop, who was a cloth merchant. You know, everything was in front of him that a normal human being would think was desirable. And then he began to have experiences. And first he had to go to war because the towns were always fighting each other. He was sent to prison. He was captured early in the conflict. He spent some time in prison. He came back. He went to war again. He became sick. He spent many weeks just lying in his room, unable to follow through on any of the promise that his life had in front of him. And in that state where suddenly everything that looked like it was going to work was broken from him, he had to go deeper and deeper into his own sense of self-awareness. Who am I really? If I'm not active and able to lead the happy pack through the street, who am I then? Does all my happiness come from the wealth of my father and the social position? Who am I? Where does my happiness come from? And by the time he got up from that sick bed, he had penetrated so much deeper into the possibilities of his own consciousness that he simply was a different man. And he wandered in the hills, and all of the joy-giving pursuits that had characterized his life up to that point, it wasn't that he had to steadfastly say, "Oh, no, I don't really want it." It just looked different to him. You see, the darkness that we live in is the darkness of our own definition of happiness, of our own definition of self, of our own definition of who I am and what I want. And the light shines in that darkness all the time. And it's not that all those desires are evil in any way. That's a great misunderstanding, to think that we're evil by nature and that all the things of this world were meant for us to repudiate as ugly. That's not at all what it means. It's just that they're all on that spectrum. They're just on that spectrum, and they just have a limited capacity to give us what we really need. And our darkness is that we just don't believe that. We just really, 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 really don't believe that. But there are inherent laws of the universe. And this is where the difficulty comes. In Master's book, The Essence of Self-Realization, Laws of Life. Just as the physical world is made in a certain way. You know, if you take your car out and drive it very fast and turn it and drive into a concrete wall, there will be consequences. And those consequences are likely to be really icky, you know, really terrible. The car will smash, you will smash, maybe your body will become untenable and you'll find yourself in the astral world. You can say over and over again, I want it to be different. And you can just smash that car into the wall over and over and over. But every time, there are laws. We think of them as physical laws, but they're laws of the universe. And so we live in the self-created darkness of our just inability entirely to believe the masters. Or we don't even know the masters are out there. We haven't even risen to the point where we don't believe them. In the Gita, it talks about the various stages of spiritual understanding. And the first stage, I mean, we don't even know it's out there, and it progresses. And my favorite one is, as soon as people start talking spiritual truth to you, you fall asleep. It's just like, I'm just not going to hear this. I really don't want to know. I'm going to make my life work the way I'm going to make it work. And what happens to us is we just gradually discover the laws of life. One of the characters in the story last night, Kamala, young. She was young when she met Master. Of course, she lived her whole life knowing him. But she prayed, and she was famous for this prayer, that she prayed to God to bring all her karma, the way it was put in the play, all her karmic debts into this one lifetime so she could just pay them all off and be done with it. When we were young devotees at Ananda Village and we first heard about this, in our small world, famous prayer of the disciple Kamala, we would all sort of look at each other and ask, who has the nerve to pray that? I didn't even consider it. It just made my blood run cold even to think about it. God knows, you know, what there is, what we've done. Because you see, anything that we inflict on others, any misunderstandings we have about truth, any time we try to take our own advantage over someone else's advantage, the law of life is it must balance. That's why it's called a karmic debt. Oh, I really want this, whatever it might be, your money, your house, your position. Nowadays, our society is so confused. They teach you how to get other people's stuff. You know, they teach you how to manipulate your position until you have advantage over this one and can take advantage like that. They teach you how to be shrewd in all these different ways, and they just set us up for those karmic debts, that we think we're going to have something that is not ours by right, that is not really, we haven't really earned it. We've just made it happen and we can have it, and we think, well, that's their problem. Well, you see, it's really our problem. It's our problem for the first reason is, whenever dissonance runs through us, we become dissonant. And whatever it does to the person around you, it's much more powerful, as Swami puts it, at its point of origin. If we're sending dissonance out into the world, by the time it reaches wherever its intended goal is, it's already dissipated a bit. The atmosphere weakens it. But where it starts, that's where the force is. And so we become dissonant, we become greedy, we become inconsiderate, we become unkind. You know, all of us have these moments. I have a very fast mind, and my tongue is faster even than my mind. And I have, in my life, you know, left a lot of things in my wake that I didn't even know were there, just by barreling through. And yes, of course, intention counts for much. Master says, and this is the comfort, God reads the heart. Often inadvertently we do things we didn't really mean to do because we just didn't know. You know, many people come to me with things they did, but they didn't know. And God reads the heart. That's the comfort. But sometimes we mean to be mean, don't we? Just a little bit of it. And what it does, it just sets a wave up this way and that wave must come down. That's the karmic debt. Until we are perfectly content within ourselves, we're bound to all those waves and we just ride them. Kamala had the nerve to make that prayer. Just everything that needs to be balanced, give it to me. I've hardly even gotten to the point where I say, I want to pray that. Maybe I want to pray that. Maybe I'm there. I don't know. That's the darkness, you see. And the light shines in that darkness. And the light tells us over and over again, my children, you are living in one reality, but there really is another one. And the masters try to help us. I in the book I wrote about Swami, there's one particular story. You know, there was a person at Ananda, very, very devoted soul, who became wrapped up in a direction that was not going to be ultimately the most fulfilling. And when that person came to Swami and said, sir, you know, this is what I'm thinking of doing. And Swamiji had to be very, very careful, because even a master, especially a great soul, knows you can't interfere. You don't help someone by just saying, no, no, you can't have that. 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 Even if you can suppress those desires in yourself, you don't understand. Why? Why can't I have it? Swamiji said, to be pious merely because you're afraid to sin is not the same as being good. And so a lot of times we're pious because we're just afraid to sin, but that's not freedom. We still think the sin would be happier than the piety. And so when a master is confronted with someone who the master knows, there's no way to tell them except their own experience. So Swamiji, in this particular situation, said, the person asked, will you bless what I'm going to do? And Swami said very lovingly, I bless you. Very careful choice of words. Master's a superb editor. Swamiji was a superb editor. He always knew exactly what he said. And afterwards, as it happened, I was engaged in behind the scenes on that one. He sighed and he said, well, I bless the person. They went away thinking I blessed their plan. He said, so he just had to let the karma run. Swami said about Master, as much as possible, Master, let us live out our fantasies. That's a really scary thought, isn't it? As much as possible, he just lets you live them out. You can't say, if you don't want me to do this, stop me. There was a man who said that to Swami Kriyananda once. If Master doesn't want me to do this, he'll stop me. After the man walked out of the room, Swamiji said, why should he? The light shining in the darkness, but this man doesn't comprehend it. So why should Master break down his resistance? We resist the light. The light is not affected, you see. The only thing that's affected is us. So this dear soul, whom Master wanted to spare the karma, had to live through it. That's all. That's all that happened. The wave went up in enthusiasm and the wave went down in disappointment. The devotee crawled along for a while until the balance was attained. Came there again. I myself went to Swami once and said, sir, I know what you're asking of me is a good thing, but I do not have it in me to do it. Well, he said, so much for theory. Let's deal with reality. And that was about, no, I would have liked to spare you the karma. That's what he's saying. I would have liked to spare you the karma. But if the experience is required, The light shines in the darkness, and the darkness comprehends it not. And only one thing happens. Only one thing happens. You have to understand this. We get to suffer a little longer. One modern teacher said, oh, if you fight for your delusions, here's what you get. You get to keep them. That's the prize. You don't get damned to hell. You don't get turned away by God. You don't become somehow less his child. You just get to stumble around in the dark and hit the walls and bang your feet and bang up against the furniture for a little while longer. How much longer? Really, it just depends on the longing of the heart. How much? When are we done? And one has to be, I've said this to all of us because I say it to myself many times, you can't fake it. You know, you just can't fake it. You can say, I want this, I want this, I don't want that. But that's why we sing things like, how shall I love thee, Lord my God, with every breath I breathe. That's such a beautiful melody and such a beautiful sentiment. How shall I serve thee? How shall I worship thee? With every breath I breathe. Just as the fire can burn a whole forest, burn away my desires. And that's the prayer that actually works. Because if the divine light burns away the desires, then the light is shining and the darkness is gone. And then we look around and we think, just like Francis, he came out of that illness. He repudiated his wealthy life. He repudiated his comfort. He repudiated his position. And everyone thought, what a boatload of suffering he's taking on. But for him, you see, it had all shifted. He saw now that what he'd been doing was living in darkness, just grasping at all those worldly things, imagining that they were eternal. You see, that's the difference. One lasts for a little while, and one lasts for eternity. My character in the play, Sister Gyanamata, 4 years old when her mother died, her father died. And her mother was left, I believe, with 3 small children to raise. She was the oldest, I think, and she was 4. She had at least one other sibling. Her mother's parents were very well-to-do, but disapproved of her mother for various reasons. There was a whole story behind that. Because Gyanamata was so much wiser than her mother, the mother confided in her 4 years old. So at 4 years old, she hears all about the trials and troubles of the adult life. But the way Gyanamata turned that was, she just looked at that world and said, no, thank you, Lord. And the more her mother talked about her suffering, instead of her becoming as people do, oh, what a miserable childhood I had. I didn't have this, I didn't have that. My mother this, my mother that. She just looked at what her mother was going through and said, no, thank you, Lord. And her line in the play, which is her own words, I was determined to base my life on eternal realities. And so she did. God alone. That was her motto. And even if we don't entirely want God alone, let us at least resolve to want God alone. So that with every breath we breathe, we may love, worship, and serve. God bless.